with the pregnancy and live, and the fact that he may well have been having a extramarital affair for many, many, many years with Camilla Parker Bowles while he was actually still married to Princess Diana. So I think he's going to struggle in the role, and I think within the next 20 years we will see a breakup of the United Kingdom. So you will see Ireland reunified, you will see Scotland independent, and possibly Wales. So you will have Charles as King of England and nothing else, and a diminishing Commonwealth. And I believe that there is a growing call that Britain should become a republic, and that this kind of anachronistic, old-fashioned monarchy, which many people believe is dripping with blood, it's maybe time to move on.
All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Thanks to political analyst Shebby Rezvi joining us from the British capital, London. And thanks to journalist, author and activist Fra Hughes speaking to us from Belfast. And, of course, a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. Bye, everybody.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قُلْ إِن تُخْفُوا مَا فِي صُدُورِكُمْ أَوْ تُبْدُوهُ يَعْلَمْهُ اللَّهُ وَيَعْلَمُ مَا فِي السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء قدير يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran hits out at three major European countries for their statement on JCPOA revival talks, advising them against walking in the footsteps of Israel. Russian troops regrouping in eastern Kharkiv or eastern Ukraine as Kiev announces major territorial gains in several parts of Donetsk region. Also, the French city of Lille switches off lights at public buildings in a bid to reduce energy consumption ahead of winter. Welcome. We are coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Thank you for joining us. Iran has rejected as unconstructive a statement by three European countries censuring Tehran's stance in the JCPOA revival talks. Foreign Ministry spokesman says, it's a regret that France, Britain, and Germany have issued such an uncalculated statement as talks to revive the 2015 accord are still ongoing. Nasser Kanani warned the three European countries against walking in the footsteps of Israel, which is trying to derail the JCPOA revival talks. He says the European countries should accept responsibility for the consequences if they continue on this path. The European trio said in their statement they have quote-unquote serious doubts over Iran's sincerity in seeking a nuclear agreement. They warned that Tehran's position jeopardizes prospects of restoring the 2015 accord. We have talked to political commentator Sayed Mostafa Khoshish about the reason why the JCPOA revival talks have not been fruitful so far.
All throughout the past 10 months or 11 months, Iran has been the only party that has been offering initiatives. And the only time that the Western parties offered a new initiative was the last in the Vienna talks. But still, they tried to reserve some concessions, some very important points for Iran that are called Iranian red lines, a closure of the IAEA cases, and removal of 3-4 ambiguous words that seem to be something subtle, something small, but they are not. They are a world. I mean, they are trying to trap Iran, actually. They are trying to just receive some energy supplies probably for a few months and then ruin the accord again. So they are playing fool, actually, with Iran. And since Iran has stressed that it has been very much constructive in the talks all throughout the past several months, it expects the Europeans and Americans, especially the Europeans that are facing very cold winter, they need Iranian crude, of course not gas, but the Iranian crude that could be much helpful to their economies and could save lives in Europe. But they still insist on pressuring Iran empty-handed.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it has seized a foreign vessel carrying some 757,000 liters of diesel out of the country. An IRGC official said the vessel aimed to smuggle the fuel to other countries. The official added seven members of the unnamed vessel, who were all foreign nationals, have been handed over to legal authorities. The fight against smuggling is among the priorities of IRGC's naval forces. Since March, more than 1.5 million liters of diesel has been seized by IRGC's Navy. Iran warns of ramifications of the growing military partnership between the U.S. and Israel in the Persian Gulf region. Iran says the U.S. military has tried to make up for the withdrawal of its warships from the region by connecting the Israeli military to the U.S. Tehran has obviously slammed, whether financially, military.
Iran's top general has warned of the ramifications of the treaty between the U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM, and the Israeli military, saying public interprets the development as a direct threat to its security. Chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Baghdadi, wrote in an online message that the terrorist U.S. military has tried to compensate for the withdrawal of its aircraft carriers, helicopter carriers, and destroyers from the Persian Gulf and the Oman Sea by connecting the child-killing Israeli military to CENTCOM.
The meaning of this action is that, from our point of view, the spying and even operational facilities of the United States and its allies will be at the disposal of the occupying Zionist regime, and this will increase the threat to our beloved country.
Message. Baghdadi also said the regional countries that host American forces, Iran, which sees the U.S. presence as a serious threat.
In addition to written announcements, war waged through the foreign ministry to countries hosting the U.S., we have declared our readiness and warning through expanding our, including air and sea patrols, deepening our intelligence dominance, and conducting various naval, missile, and drone exercises.
The top Iranian general further said, Iran's friendly advice to neighboring countries is to uphold brotherly relations and cooperation to establish security in the region by our own countries and not by relying on foreigners. Israel moved from U.S. European Command to CENTCOM in September of last year, with the aim of simplifying the cooperation with American occupation forces in the region. The move is also expected to expand military coordination between the Israeli regime and sub-Arab countries, which began to normalize their relations with the regime in Tel Aviv under U.S. brokered agreements in late 2020.
So this is really a response by the West, by the U.S., British, Canadian, Australian, Five Eyes military alliance, in an almost nervous reaction to their failed operations in the Middle East, from Afghanistan to Iraq to Libya to Syria, but they're also now seeing their failure in Ukraine, which is going to result in tremendous political uprisings that most likely will overthrow the ruling regimes in Europe. So I think Israel and the United States may very well try and open up a new military front against Syria, against Iran, using Iraq as a proxy. And this is the first step in that strategy.
The U.S. Central Command is trying to absorb Israel into its area of influence in the region. This as some Arab countries have also normalized their ties with the Israeli regime under U.S. brokered Abraham deals. Critics argue that the growing nexus between some Persian Gulf Arab states and Israel against Iran might instigate a regional war, or at least cause further tensions in the region.
Late last month, Israeli Minister for Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, made an unprecedented visit to the headquarters of the U.S. Central Command in Florida. During the visit, Gantz claimed that Israel's cooperation with CENTCOM and the countries of the region is a game-changer in confronting Iran, adding that Israel and the U.S. will continue deepening cooperation against Iran's peaceful nuclear program, which he charged was aimed at obtaining a nuclear weapon, a baseless accusation that Tehran has time and again rejected. Washington has also been working to improve ties between Israel and its neighbors under the U.S.-brokered Abraham Accords. The deal, commonly described as normalizing relations and establishing formal diplomatic ties between the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Sudan, and Israel. At its heart, a business deal. The Abraham Accords facilitated financial investment between the countries, as well as military and surveillance cooperation. Palestinian leaders, activists, and ordinary people have repeatedly rejected Arab-Israeli normalization deals as a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian people.
The shifting political powers in Europe and the world and the Middle East are driving the Israeli reaction. Very clearly, the pendulum of political power is shifting away from the United States and Britain and Israel, and it is shifting into Asia. So you have Russia, India, Iran, China emerging as the powerhouse countries. And Israel recognizes that the Middle Eastern regimes of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, they are all shifting to seek better relations with Russia. That being said, Israel is quickly accelerating its military plans to try and bluff and seem like it is a threat. But I think at heart, it recognizes these Middle Eastern regimes of the Wahhabi Sunni kingdoms have no political loyalty whatsoever.
Normalization is the way for the current regimes to establish their foundations and fight their peoples by transforming the battle in our region from a struggle for Palestinian and Arab rights to supporting the ambitions and plans of the occupation.
Leader of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, has arrived in Moscow to hold talks with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Haniyeh leads a senior delegation that includes Deputy Chief Saleh al-Aruri and other members of Hamas's political bureau. The resistance group says Moscow invited Hamas to discuss mutual ties and other issues, including the situation in Palestine. A Hamas delegation previously visited Russia in May amid increased tensions in the occupied Palestinian territories, particularly the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The meeting comes amid heightened tensions between Russia and Israel due to the regime's support for Ukraine and Israel's repeated attacks on Syria. Almost 7 months into the war with Russia, a Ukrainian offensive to retake control of its territory is gathering pace. Here's the Ukrainian president talking about the scale of his army's achievements.
The movement of our soldiers in different directions of the front continues. At present, about 2,000 square kilometers of our territory have been liberated in the framework of active operations since the beginning of September.
Zelensky claimed the Russian army is fleeing the area, adding there is no place for what he called occupiers in his country. The foreign ministry has also said the advances show Ukrainian forces are able to defeat the Russian army. It called on Western countries to continue to deliver weapons. Russia has confirmed a drawdown from eastern Kharkiv, but says troops in Balakilia and Izium regions are regrouping along the Donetsk front. Ukraine also says its troops are closing in on the eastern city of Lysychansk, which Russian forces captured 2 months ago. An offensive is also ongoing around the Russian-held Kherson region in the south, with Moscow dispatching reinforcements there. Civic officials in the northern French city of Lille have stopped lighting of public buildings to reduce energy consumption as Europe grapples with soaring energy prices ahead of winter. The measure is part of a package that also includes lowering temperature in most public buildings and pools, as well as closing the city's tropical garden in two fountains. The whole package is expected to cut the city's energy use by 7%. France, like other European nations, faces a hike in fuel prices due to reduced gas supply from Russia following the war in Ukraine. In Britain, the largest energy supplier, Centrica, is planning to voluntarily cap profits in an effort to cut household costs. That after new premier Liz Truss vowed to cap soaring energy bills for 2 years to protect consumers and businesses. A new report on poverty in France has revealed the devastating economic effects caused by Europe's sanctions on Russia over the Ukraine war. Multiple indicators have reached record lows, showing that their lower classes are worse off than in decades. Rami Mazoeri has more from Paris.
The annual report from one of France's top NGOs revealed that poverty has already skyrocketed this year. And that's at what many say is only the beginning of years of inflation and recession provoked by sanctions on Russia over the unrest in Ukraine. Secours Populaire found that the number of people who say they have known poverty has increased 9% in just the past year. That's the biggest increase in 30 years. This year, over 40% of France says they can't pay their transport, medical, energy, or childcare bills, or go on vacation, or even buy fruits and vegetables. It's the highest percentage they've ever recorded.
The poverty question in France is one that's been central, but the social safety net is running out. It's just going to get worse and worse for the poor people, because they're not going to be able to afford this stuff, you know? And the French are not going to be able to subsidize these cost of living increases the way they did.
The steep increase in poverty comes after a decade of failed austerity policies and a deep devaluing of the euro currency. The government just announced they expect the next two economic quarters to produce a growth rate of 0.2%, and then 0%. Many predict that the essentially recession-level economy will soon begin massive layoffs. That combination spells stagflation, and it's something for which liberal economics has no theoretical remedy. This adds to the feeling of unease, especially among the investor class and high finance.
France has a pretty good record of having a social safety net for those who are on bottom as far as health care is concerned and other basic necessities. But since Macron got elected, a lot of those things have changed because Macron has decided that he's going to attack that social safety net.
The report showed that a near universal 85% of France is worried for the future generations. That's also the highest percentage ever recorded. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Charles III has been formally proclaimed king by the UK's Accession Council, a ceremonial body that confirms the new monarch.
I am deeply aware of this great inheritance and of the duties and heavy responsibilities of sovereignty, which have now passed to me. In taking up these responsibilities, I shall strive to follow the inspiring example I have been set in upholding constitutional government and to seek the peace, harmony, and prosperity of the peoples of these islands and of the Commonwealth realms and territories throughout the world.
Charles succeeds his mother, Queen Elizabeth II, who died on Thursday at the age of 96 after more than 7 decades of rule. The televised ceremony was held at St. James Palace, where the Accession Council assembles upon the death of a monarch to make a formal proclamation of the successor to the throne. Former prime ministers and other top officials attended the ceremony. A state funeral is to be held for the late queen in just over a week.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
in the limelight.
Queen Elizabeth's death is seen by many as the end of a person who for decades inflicted different forms of violence and brutality against world people, which included colonialism, racism, occupation, coups, etc. But unfortunately, we have to admit that the Queen's legacy will live on in the form of the violent and lasting rule that the royal family has overseen and still profits from. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. This is the first part. According to Crescent International, during her long reign, some would say way too long, Queen Elizabeth presided over two things. Number one, the slaughter of millions of brown and black-skinned people in Asia and Africa by successive regimes in Britain. Number two, huge sex scandals among her family members. Her late younger sister, Princess Margaret, couldn't get enough. She romped around the country and abroad having fun. Then it was her daughter, Prince Anne's turn. She, too, was never satisfied. Prince, now King Charles, was another philanderer. The day he was getting married to Diana, he ran off to have a fling with Camilla Parker Bowles, someone would say Bowles. Diana was driven to despair and an untimely death. But what Charles saw in Miss Bowles in anybody's guess, but as saying goes, beauty lies in the eyes of the beholder. Now Charles, as king, can have as much fun as he wants. As loyal subjects, a word of caution is in order for the new monarch. King Charles III should look over his shoulder lest the Cromwell-type figure emerges. His predecessor, King Charles I, did not have a happy ending, losing one's head on the chopping block can hardly qualify as a pleasant experience. The website of Truth Out wrote, for millions of people who lived through and still suffer the consequences of the royal family's brutal colonialism and racism, both abroad and in the UK, the Queen's legacy will live on in the form of violent and lasting rule that the royal family has overseen and still profits from. Critics say the royal family still hasn't confronted its past or paid reparations for the people who continue to suffer as a result of the British monarchy, decades on from direct colonial rule. The royal family has also faced criticism for appearing to attempt to sweep its history under the rug, especially during the Queen's Platinum Jubilee this year. By design as much as by the accident of her long life, her presence as head of state and head of the Commonwealth, an association of Britain and its former colonies put a stolid traditionalist front over decades of violent upheaval, wrote Harvard University history professor Maya Janoff for the New York Times, adding, as such, the Queen helped obscure a bloody history of decolonization whose proportions and legacies have yet to be adequately acknowledged. NBC News wrote this headline saying, Queen Elizabeth's death revives criticism of Britain's legacy of colonialism. According to NBC, critics are responding to the relationship of the monarchy to systems of oppression, repression, and forced extraction of labor, and particularly African labor, and exploitation of natural resources, and forcing systems of control in these places, one professor said. The death of Queen Elizabeth II revived criticism of her legacy, highlighting the complicated feelings of those who saw her as a symbol of the British colonial empire an institution that enriched itself through violence, theft, and oppression.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Real Royals. Part 2.
Welcome to the Sailors' Church. I invite you to join me in prayer or to take this moment for personal reflection, to remember all that was beautiful, great and good in the life of
the UK has both historically and contemporaneously prided itself on its tradition of open wills, whereby wills are open to inspection by the public, mostly out of concern to prevent theft and abuse of authority. And yet the royal family has dissented from this long-established national practice by their ability, since 1910, to seal their wills. The untimely death in 1910 of errant Prince Francis, the brother-in-law of King George V, set in stone a tradition which the British royal family jealously guards to this day, the concept and practice of sealed wills. The catalyst for the un-British practice of sealed wills was Prince Francis' erratic, if not reckless, lifestyle, best exemplified by his compulsive gambling and extreme womanizing. In his will, Francis is believed to have left priceless family jewels to one of his more flamboyant mistresses, Ellen Constance, the Countess of Kilmery, with whom he was rumored to have had an illegitimate child. This significant act of indiscretion and breach of protocol spurred the royal family into action, first by suppressing the will and subsequently reaching out to Ellen Constance with a hefty bribe, £10,000 to be exact, which amounts to £700,000 in today's money. For the past 100 years or so, English courts have upheld the monarchy's demand that wills of its members, in stark contrast to the wills of the general public, should be sealed and, in effect, kept secret in perpetuity. On the few occasions when this self-declared right to secrecy has been challenged in the courts, notably in 2006 by one Robert Brown, who claims he is an illegitimate child of the deceased Princess Margaret, this has been quashed by the Queen's judges. the precedent set by the suppression of the will of Prince Francis, above all, demonstrates that the British legal system, rooted firmly in the principles of English law, never flinches when it comes to accommodating the whims and fancies of the monarchy. This was in evidence, most recently, in the aftermath of the demise of Elizabeth Angela Marguerite Bowes Loyne, also known as the Queen Mother, who died in March 2002.
A mother, a mum, the Queen Mum.
In keeping with royal tradition, established in 1910 in the wake of Prince Francis's demise, the Queen Mother's will was sealed up on the orders of the High Court, which means that on present trajectory, in view of the total hegemony of the monarchy, it is closed to inspection and publication in perpetuity. The blanket secrecy surrounding royal wills is central to the secrecy in which they conduct all their personal affairs. From wealth accumulation to the conduct of sordid affairs and other scandalous relationships, the case of Diana's husband, Prince Charles, speaks volumes. Diana's husband and her heir to the throne, who is no stranger to sordid and secret affairs. Charles's most infamous escapades was with his childhood sweetheart, Camilla Parker Bowles, with whom he started a secret affair in 1986, 5 years after his marriage with Diana. This is the same Prince Charles whose love for hunting animals is equal to, if not excessive of, his love for human flesh. An avid fox hunter, Charles once famously said he would not stop hunting foxes in the British countryside until the practice was made illegal. Fox hunting was made illegal in the UK in November 2004, and while it is not known if Prince Charles partakes in these illegal hunts, it is well known that for years he lobbied former Prime Minister Tony Blair to reappeal the ban. By all credible accounts, Charles's brother Andrew is more morally compromised, as evidenced by his long-standing relationship with the deceased American pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Prince Andrew, or the Duke of York to use his formal title, is the quintessential royal playboy, as demonstrated by his long list of romantic entanglements, even after his ill-fated marriage to Sarah Ferguson in 1986. Beginning in 1980, the Duke of York has conducted affairs with an astonishing number of glamorous women, including the former playboy model Courtney Love, reality TV star Caroline Stanbury, and the American photographer and actress Coo Stark. Andrew's wife of 10 years, the notoriously volatile Sarah Ferguson, was also no stranger to scandal and sordid affairs. Her immoral and carefree lifestyle exploded onto the public domain after photos of her lounging by the pool with her financial advisor, the Texan millionaire John Bryan, kissing and sucking her toes were published. However, what the British public sees in the way of royal scandals, which erupt onto the public sphere from time to time, is merely the tip of the proverbial iceberg. Plenty of dodgy dealings take place behind the scenes, which the public never hears about, as the monarchy's ironclad secrecy, enforced by the courts and broader machinery of state, shows no sign of relenting. The British monarchy exerts influence from behind the scenes in a carefully choreographed effort to present the British system as a parliamentary democracy with minimal interference in the nation's day-to-day affairs by the Queen. But like everything else in modern Britain, appearances can be deceptive. Even the most intrinsic feature of modern government, namely legislation. On the surface, the process of legislation in the UK is undertaken by both the Houses of Parliament and the government of the day, playing a central role in introducing proposed legislation in the form of bills. But the monarch plays an influential role both at the beginning and end of the legislative process through the Queen's consent and assent.
with the former signifying the sovereign's agreement with parliamentary debate on a proposed piece of legislation, and the latter marking the sovereign's seal of approval to a bill that has successfully completed the parliamentary process.
Grateful, and I think my views on this are pretty well understood.
Indeed, a bill only becomes an act or law of the land once it has been granted royal assent by the Queen. It might be argued that none of this dissents in a fundamental way from the principles of constitutional monarchy insofar as the sovereign is expected to play a symbolic role in the legislative process. But nothing could be further from the truth. As the Queen actively employs her power of withholding consent for proposed legislation, often in concert with and the active collusion of a sitting government. This often occurs when a sitting government wants to stop proposed legislation which originates from the inner circles of policymaking. Therefore, briefing the Queen and persuading her to withhold her consent from the bill, to be even discussed in Parliament, is the most effective way of stopping inconvenient proposed legislation in its tracks. In keeping with the British tradition of secrecy, records are not kept as to how many times the Queen has exercised her power to withhold consent from proposed legislation entering the parliamentary fray.
In the House of Peers.
But the public know of at least three occasions. The Titles Bill, 1964. The Rhodesia Independence Bill, 1969. And the Military Action Against Iraq Bill, 1999. On all three occasions, the bills were proposed by backbenchers in the House of Commons, and on all three occasions, the sitting government quashed the initiatives by way of persuading the Queen to intervene.
Her attack on the BBC.
In fact, whereas the UK is continually at pains to project itself as the world's leading parliamentary democracy, with Parliament supposedly acting as the will of the people, the truth is that an unelected sovereign plays a central role in the legislative process, both in passive and active capacities. In February 2021, The Guardian revealed that more than 1,000 laws have been vetted by the Queen or Prince Charles through a secretive procedure before they were approved by the UK's elected members of Parliament. The huge number of laws subject to royal vetting cover matters ranging from justice, social security, pensions, race relations, and food policy, through to obscure rules on car parking charges and hovercraft. The wealth of the royal family in terms of fixed assets is concentrated in two crown bodies, the Duchy of Lancaster and Duchy of Cornwall. The Duchy of Lancaster is by far the most consequential, as it constitutes the private estate of the sovereign Queen Elizabeth II. The Duchy of Cornwall, meanwhile, belongs to the eldest son of the reigning monarch, which currently is Prince Charles. These holdings, or crown bodies, to use British political jargon, merely represents the vast estates, including palaces, that belong to the royal family and which the state upkeeps with taxpayers' money. But the Queen's wealth, as well as other leading members of the royal family, exceeds the value of the buildings and lands held by the two duchies. As far back as 2001, the Mail on Sunday calculated that the Queen was worth £1.15 billion, with her vast investment portfolio worth £500 million alone. The Queen reportedly is an avid collector of expensive and exotic items. Her collection alone was worth an eye-watering £100 million. But as faithful as he was to the pertinent facts, Hall's description was, by all credible accounts, an underestimate. In 2017, the Paradise Paper leak revealed that millions of pounds from the private estate of Britain's Queen Elizabeth II had been invested in offshore tax haven funds. The royal family doesn't have to pay a single penny for the upkeep of the vast estates under their control. And needless to say, members of the royal household don't pay a single penny in income tax either, or any other form of tax for that matter. And that's just the beginning, as the royal family receives a more than generous stipend from the state to maintain their lavish lifestyles, all at the expense of the out-of-pocket British taxpayer. The current legislative framework for funding the lifestyle and expenses of the royal family is embodied in the Sovereign Grant Act 2011, which replaced the civil list mechanism established by King George III in 1760. On the face of it, the new arrangement is advantageous to the monarchy, as income from the old civil list in the years 2001 to 2011 was fixed at £7.9 million annually. By contrast, in 2012, the new sovereign grant scheme funneled an exorbitant £1 million into the pockets of the royal household. In the year 2018 to 2019, this had increased to a staggering £82.8 million, and by all accounts, it is set to rise by at least 8 to 10% annually for the foreseeable future. To place financial arrangements on a more favourable footing, the royals could always rely on the Tory party, which had for the past 180 years, since its foundation in the 1830s, championed the cause of monarchy as part of its broader right-wing political and ideological agenda.
If Parliament were a school.
When the Conservative Party came to power following the May 2010 general election, albeit as part of a coalition government with the Liberal Democrats, they quickly set about abolishing the civil list arrangement of 1760. The then Tory Chancellor, George Osborne, contrived a scheme, doubtless in close consultation with the Queen and her son Prince Charles, which would replace the 1760 deal with a new arrangement whereby a percentage of the profits of the Crown estate would be diverted to royal accounts. This was initially set at 15% of profits annually, but has subsequently been increased to 25% to cover a bells and whistles upgrade to Buckingham Palace. Osborne and the Tories went the extra mile to please the Queen and her eldest son. For, as part of the new deal, if income from the Crown estates fell one year, the royals would be compensated for the loss. And vice versa, in the event of above-inflation income stream, the royals get to pocket the excess. The arrangement of 2011 has all the trappings of placing the royal family above the vicissitudes of the British economy. Despite its massive constitutional significance and considerable financial implications, information about this new arrangement was kept to a small circle within the government. It was rushed through a small committee in the House of Commons, with only the Scottish National Party objecting to its terms.
This is almost the kind of behaviour we would expect to see in the Duma in Moscow.
To make matters worse, the draft legislation was personally delivered to Prince Charles by the pliant Tory Chancellor Osborne so that the Queen's eldest son could issue his consent to the proposed legislation. Britain is not an anomaly in Europe in terms of having a monarchy. Excluding the UK, there are 9 monarchies left in Europe. But what sets the European monarchies apart from Britain's royal family is their genuine and robust constitutional status, in addition to multiple layers of oversight exercised over them to prevent abuse of power and privilege. For example, under Article 19 of the Norwegian Constitution, In order for the king to accede to the throne, he has to make the following pledge. I promise and swear that I will govern the Kingdom of Norway in accordance with the Constitution. Similarly, Article 32 of the Dutch Constitution requires that the king shall swear or promise allegiance to the Constitution, and that he will faithfully discharge his duties. The remaining monarchies in Europe are truly constitutional, insofar as they are subordinate to the policies which they purport to represent. By stark contrast, the British monarchy stands not only above democracy, but above the law itself. Indeed, they like to think they are the law, inasmuch as they do whatever they please, including accumulating wealth without paying a penny in tax. Seen in this context, the British royal family constitutes Europe's largest imperial monarchy, apparently impervious to the vicissitudes of politics and history. It doesn't stop there, as even their upkeep far exceeds that of their European counterparts. The decadence and greed of the British monarchy puts European monarchies, indeed monarchies across the world, to shame. As for palaces, for example, the Spanish, Dutch, and Danish royal families each have access to only two palaces. The House of Windsor, meanwhile, occupies 15 state residences, and that figure excludes privately owned estates like Balmoral Castle and Sandringham House. Monarchies around the world are adapting fast to political developments, if only to ensure their survival in an age of forensic scrutiny. Japan, which credibly claims to be the oldest monarchy in the world, is leading the way by trying to create as much distance as possible between the royal family and public expenditure. Prince Akashino, who is next in line to succeed Emperor Naruhito, announced that the royal family should cover the expense of succession ceremony from its own funds, as opposed to relying on the state treasury to cover the costs. This is a world away from the dreamscape occupied by Queen Elizabeth II, her heirs and entourage. Despite their vast wealth, the royals make liberal use of public resources for their own pleasure and comfort. For instance, Prince William, who many believe will be the next king as Charles may abdicate in favor of his oldest son, once used a military helicopter to fly to a stag party. By the same token, the royals are not shy of using fabulously wealthy people's private resources either. In 2018, the American actor and producer George Clooney treated Prince Harry and his wife Meghan Markle to a decadent holiday in Italy. Clooney reportedly flew the royal couple there in his private jet and gave them unfettered access to his luxurious 25-room villa. The question is, what, if anything, Clooney got in return for his extraordinary generosity? When the scandal about the couple's pension for private jets first broke out, some observers were puzzled as to why the singer and songwriter Elton John had been so keen to leap to Harry and Meghan's defense. The answer may lie in the fact that the royal family uses its wealth and privilege to cultivate famous and influential types, exactly for such occasions when it needs to polish up its public image. Modern Britain is a country of contrasts, not to mention deep contradictions. The dizzyingly complex mix of traditions, mores, and an apparently insatiable postmodern impulse has created a country that is hard to decipher, let alone fully understand. And so it is with the monarchy. On the surface, most Britons appear to support the antiquated institution, not just on the grounds of sentimentalism, but also good old-fashioned British pragmatism. And yet, the UK is home to a small but vocal Republican community.
I'm here to protest the unaccountable power of the Crown, what it symbolises, which is hereditary privilege, and the constitutional power that it still has.
We don't need that kind of icon. You know, much better icons are, you know, things like ideas like democracy and the equality of citizenship, and maybe someone chosen by us to represent us.
The fact of the matter is, there is no credible evidence or indication even that the British public wants to abolish the monarchy, except for very cosmetic changes to the monarchy and only to placate public anger. Never to reform the monarchy itself. Based on this clear political reality, the British monarchy is set to survive the 21st century, perhaps with little, if any, substantial change. But a parallel development points to the diminution of the UK's role in the world. Perhaps even the breakup of the UK itself, as evidenced by the strengthening independence movement in Scotland and, to a lesser extent, Wales. As Britain becomes more parochial, the rest of the world is likely to care much less about the House of Windsor, and that may be a punishment worse than death for Britain's media-conscious royal family.
In the limelight.
It seems that the unfavorable situation of the American economy, which is now facing high inflation and unprecedented recession, has caused the concern of the U.S. administration and prompted the White House to increase the sale of arms and ammunition to its foreign allies and partners around the world. These actions are contrary to President Joe Biden's previous promises. According to the latest reports by U.S. media, in the midst of the American economic crisis and the trade war with China, Joe Biden decided to increase U.S. arms sales and lift the ban on arms exports to Saudi Arabia and to the United Arab Emirates. This is whilst numerous reports of war crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition against innocent people in Yemen have been published. We now take a look at some of the world press and news agencies' coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The World Socialist website writes, just a few weeks after US President Joe Biden's visit to Saudi Arabia, aimed at shoring up relations with the Riyadh regime, his administration has approved two massive arms sales worth more than $5 billion to Saudi Arabia and to the United Arab Emirates. It follows $650 million in air-to-air missiles sent to Riyadh in November of 2021 for its criminal war against the civilian population in Yemen. Included in these sales are Patriot missiles costing $3 billion for Saudi Arabia, and a high-altitude missile system costing $2.2 billion for the United Arab Emirates, aimed at protecting the monarchs from rocket attacks. Joe Biden has pledged during his election campaign to treat Saudi Arabia as a pariah state due to its appalling human rights record, and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman signing off on Saudi journalist and dissident Jamal Khashoggi's gruesome assassination in 2018. He also promised to cut off or cut back on the sale of offensive weapons to both Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, citing their attacks on innocent people in Yemen. But this has counted for nothing next to the more pressing needs of Washington's geostrategic interests. Ever since Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates-led coalition invaded Yemen in April of 2015, international human rights groups, including the New York-based Human Rights Watch and the London-based Campaign Against the Arms Trade, have documented the coalition's use of American and British weapons in unlawful airstrikes, including undoubted war crimes, breaching Washington and London's own policies on arms sales. The antiwar.com website explains more about this issue. Recently, the Biden administration announced over $2.8 billion in military aid for Ukraine and U.S. allies in the region. The announcement came as U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken made a surprise visit to Kiev, and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin chaired a meeting of defense ministers in Germany. In Kiev, Anthony Blinken met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and other officials and said the administration was providing $2.2 billion in foreign military financing for Ukraine and 17 other countries in the region.